now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Chad Stemke. Chad is a veteran researcher up in the wilds of Michigan. He's researched vortex areas, wide variety of anomalous phenomena, missing persons, cryptids, alien UFO manifestations, et cetera, et cetera. Chad is in the right spot at the right time because I see a confluence of events. I see kind of almost a singularity forming right now with all these different threads being interwoven together. And we must never forget that there seems to be, at least in my estimation, a non-human factor at work behind a lot of these major events. So without any further ado, Chad Stemke, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Hey, James. Thank you so much for having me. I truly, truly appreciate the invite. Looking forward to our conversation.
The pleasure is all ours, Chad. For the benefit, and we'll have all of Chad's website and YouTube information on our dedicated website and YouTube channel, so our listeners can visit your site. Tell us a bit about yourself, Chad, and the voyage of discovery, how you came to do what you do.
Initially, I started off with a couple UFO sightings. I wasn't into any type of this stuff. My whole family was super science-based. My dad's a science teacher, stepdad's a science teacher, sister's a science teacher. So I wasn't into this. And then one day I had a UFO sighting. And, you know, I had to try to figure out what I had seen, you know, and I didn't tell nobody. I didn't even think of telling anybody. I told my wife, but no friends, you know. And I spent another year or two just kind of pondering it and, you know, kind of doing a little research. And then I just had the urge. I had to talk to somebody else besides my wife about this. So during my research, I kind of got a little bit into Zechariah Sitchin, and he was giving one of his last talks in Chicago. So I hopped in my car and I drove out there and enjoyed his talks and enjoyed being able to get to meet people and talk about this stuff for the first time. And it was on my way home from that conference, I was back in Michigan, going down I-94, and this light mist broke out over the highway, creating this incredible rainbow directly over the highway. And it was as if, the best way I can describe it is as if the end of this rainbow was refracting off the wet concrete into the car. I had looked at myself in the rearview mirror, and I looked like the colors of the rainbow. My car looked like it, and I actually thought, maybe I'm having something wrong with me, but I looked over, and the cars next to me were doing the same thing, you know. They're all looking at everybody. And, you know, so I was pretty amazed, so I actually pulled off the exit and got to the top of the ramp and took some awesome pictures of it, and, you know, that was kind of that. I finished my road trip home, and I told my wife I saw this amazing rainbow. It was one of the coolest experiences ever. You know, I wasn't into rainbows, but, you know, so that night I had a super realistic dream, which up until that point I never really did. And in this dream, I was floating up to what I perceived to have been the same rainbow. And as I got close to the rainbow, this reddish orange UFO, for lack of better terms, came shooting out right in front of me, and I'll say transmitted, investigate the rainbow. And I woke up, and all I could remember besides the UFO was investigate the rainbow. So I actually got out of bed, and I hadn't even downloaded the pictures yet. It was 3:14 in the morning, to be exact. I remember the exact time. I got out of bed, I ran into the computer room, and I put in a computer chip and started scrolling through the pictures, and sure enough, on one of these pictures, the exact same reddish orange UFO was coming out of this rainbow. And if anybody's interested in seeing this picture, it's on my website. You can find the article Scaling the Shimmering Path of the Gods. And it's right at the top of that article. You can see a picture of this UFO. But it was that experience that really put me on the path. You know, from then on, it was game on. I had to figure out you know, what the heck was going on. I started investigating some of the star ancestor stories, which led me to the ancient mound sites and stone circles and, of course, extraterrestrials and UFOs. And long story short, that in a roundabout way all led me to portals and stargates and vortex areas. So that's kind of where I got the start, is UFO sightings in a roundabout way kind of led me in this on this path that's put me where I am now, investigating different geological regions that may have different portal or gateway aspects to them, where this phenomenon may be manifesting.
Interesting about the time too, 3:14 a.m., because there was a period in my life, especially when I was younger, when I always seemed to wake up at 3:14 a.m. I used to have a digital clock next to my bed when I was in high school, and insomnia being what it was, you know, 3:14, 3:14. I always drove me crazy, actually.
Well, James, my birthday is 3:14, and I wake up at 3:14 almost every single day.
Wow, March 14th.
Yeah,
March 14th, you're an Aries. Are you an Aries?
Pisces.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's very synchronistic, man. But yeah, I wake up at 3:14 constantly, and that rainbow dream, that was actually one of the first times. This just kind of came to me. That was one of the first times I actually recall waking up at 3:14. I mean, that was probably 10, 12 years ago now. But I don't know if I woke up at that time previous to that. But for the last decade or so, I wake up at 3:14 almost every single morning, man.
Wow.
So,
now, yeah. When you began investigating the lore of the Native Americans and their connection stories about the star people, and that led you inevitably to investigating the burial mounds and what have you, what were the first connections? What were the first real significant points that jumped out at you, both from your research and from an intuitive perspective?
Well, the first thing I found is when I went to research the burial mounds, and especially here in America, most of them have been torn down and built over. There are a few left. There's like Cahokia Mounds in St. Louis, and you know, there's a few mound complexes left, but 90% of them, when I went to research them, they had been built over and they were in the heart of a city now. And that's what really got me going, is because I'd go to these spots where these mounds are supposed to be, and there'd be these parks there. And then I'd start, you know, just out of curiosity, looking into these parks, and the parks would turn out to have all kinds of symbolism. And sometimes a symbolism matched the ancient legends and lore of the natives where the mound should have been there. Sometimes the symbolism was, you know, totally out there, like Egyptian symbolism and stellar symbolism that, you know, like how in the world could this end up at the same place where an ancient mound site was? But that's what I kept finding. So it really, you know, piqued my interest when I'd go to these, what were ancient landscapes. And now these parks emerged. I call them urban temples or Stargate parks. And the symbolism, you know, it matched. It's almost like that symbolism had carried over, you know, over the ages.
The sites where these occurrences happen, various manifestations of phenomena, have you noticed any kind of commonality? Is there something about the geological strata or something? Does there seem to be a certain type of mineral present at a lot of these places? Does the whole idea of ley lines and what they call in Australia song lines factor in, and also the tendency of our ancestors to put, whether it's a pile of rocks or it's a stone circle site, at these places? And do you see these burial mounds as kind of a Native American version of these stone temple sites, if you will?
I do. I think in a way what they most likely were doing is they were marking locations where they felt they could connect with other realms. And that's why, you know, eventually they would turn them into burial mounds, so they, you know, for the afterlife purposes. But I think these mounds initially were marking special locations. Sometimes they could be gravitational anomalies, sometimes magnetic anomalies. 9 times out of 10, these spots will always be on water. They'll lots of times be on a river in particular. And, you know, that's the big commonality that I think is, personally, I think what was probably happening is these ancients were going to these places, and once they recognized the energies and recognized that they could, you know, achieve forms of communication with other realms, or they were getting this information, they probably marked these locations, albeit with a mound or a stone circle. And in modern times, I think, you know, they were built over, but when the artists and architects went down there, many times I think they may have been receiving some of this same information. Because what many times happens is they'll have a contest to build these parks. Say, for instance, in Detroit, they had a contest to build a park. I talk about Hart Plaza, and they'll have, you know, 100 artists come down and walk around the landscape and get a feel for the land. Then they'll all go back and come up with their plans. And then they'll have, some judges look at the plans, and whatever plan just seemed to fit in. It just felt right, and it fit in with that landscape, will win the commission. And for whatever reason, these guys that come up with these plans that happen to contain this sometimes cosmic symbolism, sometimes Egyptian symbolism, but always symbolism that connects to other realms, it seems like, they continuously win the commission. And then, you know, they'll build the parks, and over the years, these parks, they'll add on. They'll, you know, get a new sculpture here and there for the city's birthday or centennial. And every time they'll have a contest in the same type situation. These guys will walk around what fits in good with the previous park, and they'll come up with this symbolism. And I contemplate, could they be receiving the same information, albeit possibly subconscious, when they're standing at this location trying to literally get a feel for what fits in?
Almost like a natural form of dowsing, whether they're consciously aware of it or not. And I have to wonder if some people, Chad, and I don't mean this at all in an elitist sense, if some people are more predisposed to having their antennas attuned to that level, if you will.
I think so. And I've brought this up many times. I feel like artists, architects, musicians, authors, you know, certain people think and, you know, are on certain wavelengths, and, you know, even at certain times. And I think if they're, like you said, tuned in to these landscapes, when they go down there, they may be receiving this information. And, you know, I think anybody could probably do it, but I've seen millions of people walk through these parks and not recognize one bit of the symbolism. But then if you'll pull somebody aside and talk to them for a few minutes, they'll walk through that park with, see that park in a whole new light, and it'll have a whole new effect on them. They just weren't in that space. They weren't in that frequency, and they didn't recognize it. And I think these artists and architects, that's when they go down there, they're actually trying to feel that landscape, trying to see what fits in. And that might be the right frequency or whatever, so to speak, where they can get this information. And surely that's what the natives were when they went down there. You know, they were building structures, trying to communicate, trying to tap in. And that, you know, I didn't get a lot of this information until I went down there open-minded after I first discovered. And once I started to open my eyes and realize, information just started flowing in. And I think that's kind of what happens to, you know, how they get built, why they're there, why that piece of landscape's been there for thousands of years, is there may be information, and certain people are able to tap into it.
What were some of the stories, excuse me, some of the lore from the Native Americans, and what tribes were up there in that region? Because I'm visualizing you're up there in the Great Lakes area. Yeah. It's wooded. what were the stories that came out? What kind of commonalities, and what were the major tribes that you studied, and what seemed to be their cosmology?
Yeah, so we had several different tribes throughout the state that changed over the years, but Ojibwa and Chippewa were some of the main ones that left a lot of legends behind. Some of the legends, a lot of them around the Great Lakes, were lost over time, but a lot of the legends left are from the Ojibwa and Chippewa, and they have lots of star ancestor stories. They actually have a particular piece of ground. I don't know if you're familiar with Mackinac Island. It's right at the tip of Michigan. And there's this, it's called Arch Rock, which is on Mackinac Island, where over thousands of years, this rock was carved out and it left this hundreds of foot tall arch. And they claim this arch rock on Mackinac Island, they have a specific place, is where the first star ancestor came down and mated with one of the squaws. And I mean, she was taken back to the stars and then dropped back off on the island years later. And kind of strangely, she was dropped back off on the opposite side of the island rather than Arch Rock. So it was like a mystery in this legend how she departed through Arch Rock, but manifested back in the opposite end of the island and had to walk back to the tribe. And you know, so I always bring that up when I'm talking about some of these missing people who reappear, but reappear different places. You know, we actually have a legend kind of talking about the same type of scenario where a Native American lady disappeared, went to the stars supposedly, and reappeared, you know, only to talk about her star husband. And her name was Red Wing. I don't know if you ever heard of the Detroit Red Wings, the hockey team, but that's her name was Red Wing. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that's where we got the Red Wings hockey team from. But so there are tons of legends, and there are also legends of giants. Giants were a big thing. Lots of bones were found in the mounds around Michigan. So there's lots of giant legends as well as star people legends. So I always like to make the point when I'm talking about some of these parks and places where I think this information is coming through, I personally don't know where this information is coming from exactly, because there's a lot of different possibilities. Many times they're built over mounds that contained giant bones and Native American bones. So could it be the spirits of the deceased Native Americans funneling this information? Could it be the deceased giants? Where, you know, we could go down a whole rabbit hole with that. We could go down the whole Nephilim trail and everything. Or many times it's cosmic symbolism that almost seems to be coming from elsewhere or above. So I honestly don't know where this information is coming from that all these people are picking up on. But, or it could be coming from several different sources. You know, it could all depend on time, dates, alignments, you know, and what information is filtering through. So I always like to be clear. I wish I could tell everybody, you know, where I thought this information was coming from. But to me, that's the big mystery, is that all these places, like, for instance, I've looked at 5-6 different parks really deeply here in the Midwest, and they all turn up with the same symbolism. And I mean, there's only really two possibilities for that. One, there's some big, powerful, elite group, you know, way behind the scenes that's been working for decades and decades to build these parks, which some people will take that viewpoint. But personally, after really looking into these things, I think the artists and architects are picking up on information when they go down here. And for whatever reason, they're picking up on the same information in St. Louis as the guy in Detroit did, as the guy in Tennessee did. And to me, that's what's really fascinating, is that the same information is coming from, I'll just say, an outside source. And it's manifesting many times in the forms of art and architecture here.
You know, what's interesting is for many years, and there's still this cleavage in mainstream ufology where they seem to see the extraterrestrial hypothesis as somehow distinct and apart from the interdimensional hypothesis. And I see them as two sides of the same coin. And some of the insiders from the aerospace world talk about how some of these beings are simultaneously extraterrestrial and interdimensional. It's just a question of vibrations and resonance and what have you. Mm-hmm. In the cosmology of the Native American tribes in those regions that you've been investigating, are there any alignments, and any star systems that come up more often than others, and what seems to be the lore associated with those star systems, if that's the case?
Yes, yeah, the big one that comes up in this region that I've researched, basically from a little south of Tennessee all the way up through the Great Lakes and up into Canada, is what they refer to as the Path of Souls. And the Path of Souls, basically the spirit would make a jump into the heart of Orion. So just below Orion's belt, they thought there was a portal that their souls would go through. So that's the main cosmology for this whole region of the country. And I think if anyone's interested, I think Dr. Gregory Little, he wrote a book about the Path of Souls maybe 5-6 years ago now, where he really got into detail. But they have, I don't remember the whole story off the top of my head, but like you literally go up to a certain star, you take a right across the what they call the cosmic strawberry fields, and then you had to wait to, I believe it was December 21st, and on December 21st, they would do the burial, and at that time, the path was supposed to leap through the belt of Orion, through the portal, which was the Path of Souls.
Well, that's interesting, because, you know, the commonality, the similarity with so many other cultures around the world.
Exactly. And that's one of the symbols that shows up at these parks is, you know, the constellation of Orion. In particular, I mean, the very first park I looked at, it showed up. The very first park I looked at was Detroit, because that's where I was living when I got into this. And it's called Hart Plaza. And, you know, I've been going to the plaza most of my life. I used to skateboard down there. I used to skateboard on some of these monuments. I regret it now. I feel bad about it. But I used to skateboard on these monuments. And I used to walk my dogs around. And it was my favorite place to go. It just felt awesome. You know, it was my favorite place. But once I recognized the symbolism, you know, the whole place basically changed. You know, it was just a different place. And the first thing I did is pretty much when Google Earth almost just got started, but I went on Google Earth just to take a look at it from, you know, the bird's eye perspective. And right away I recognized, cause I'd been looking at Giza and the Egyptian pyramids quite a bit at this point, but it has had an identical layout to the Giza plateau. The three main features of the park, the amphitheater, a fountain, and a pyramid, actual pyramid, were all aligned exactly like the Giza pyramids. And there was actually a causeway, just like the causeway leading to the Sphinx, but at the end of this causeway is a giant obelisk. So I started doing some research, and I even pulled up the star maps, you know, and sure enough, this plaza, not only is it correlated and aligned, looks like the Giza Plateau, but it's correlated to the constellation of Orion on the 21st of December. So, you know, first thing I was like, okay, you know, whoever built this park, did they realize they were doing that? This is in 1974 when this guy Osamu Noguchi built this park. And it was kind of hard to comprehend, but so I did some research. And well, sure enough, Osamu Noguchi, he was in Egypt for a year right before he came to Hart Plaza. And he said it was a year-long sojourn, as he called it. He took a year off from making sculptures, went to Egypt. And supposedly he said he was very interested in the relationship the Egyptians had with their pyramids and with the stars. And he came back, and the very first park he ever won the commission for after winning this contest was Hart Plaza. And he built this park, which coincidentally correlates and aligns to the pyramids in Orion. So there's two possibilities. Either Osamu Noguchi was, you know, given this information when he was in Egypt, but this is 1974. Remember, Robert Bruval came out with his Orion correlation theory in 94. So this is 20 years previous. So was he one of the very first guys to actually get this information and come back and deposit it in a plaza, but not tell anybody? You know, I've read all his interviews and everything he's ever put out there. And the closest I can come to finding him say something about this is he says, "The symbolism I deposited in this plaza won't be recognized until the time is right." So that's as close as I can come to him saying he correlated this plaza like the pyramids in Giza. But I always talk about these guys possibly picking up subconsciously when they're, you know, on these pieces of sacred landscape. So I like to point to a project that he proposed to do back in 1947. And 47 is a very important year. Maybe talk about that more in a minute. But in 1947, he had what he called a vision to create what's going to be known as the face to be seen from Mars. And it was going to be an earthen structure, an earthen mound, absolutely huge, 1 mile long by 2 miles wide, have a nose, a pillar of a nose that's going to be 1 mile tall. And his thoughts about making this sculpture was that if we were to destroy ourselves in a nuclear holocaust, this is 1947, we're testing bombs, that an outside race of extraterrestrials would be able to recognize that an advanced civilization actually once occupied the planet Earth. You know, like, he was obviously concerned we were going to blow ourselves up. So, you know, great idea. And 30 years later, of course, NASA sends back the classic images that we've all seen that appears to show a face on Mars. And, you know, lately we have Dr. John Brandenburg, who's pointed out, you know, we've studied some of the isotopes on Mars, and the isotopes point to a possible nuclear destruction. So now we have this scenario where there's a face on Mars with a possible nuclear destruction. Maybe they wanted us to recognize there was an advanced civilization on Mars at one point. And Noguchi's having this idea or vision in 1947, before we ever knew this information, about building a face to be seen from Mars in case we destroyed ourselves in a nuclear holocaust. So I always point out, man, did Noguchi have this ability to subconsciously pick up on this stuff? And if he did, when he was roaming around Detroit here trying to come up with an idea, did this pop into his head? Let's correlate this to the heavens, correlate it to the Giza pyramids. And he may not have even realized it until it was all built and sitting there on the ground. I'm not sure. But
he may have been a conduit for this information. Because I've often wondered, Chad, the whole concept of muses, musing, where thoughts actually come from. Jerry Marzinski, who I've had on the show, talks about how a lot of the negative thought inserts we get may be from these negative, and I think there's something to this, marauding archontic entities that are trying to ruin our lives in so many ways, which turn into OCD thought loops and what have you. And I've also thought along that vein of, you have all these people in the defense contractors building all these weapons of mass destruction, right? Did they come up with all of that? Or did things get slipped in somehow? A light goes on, aha, but were they really the inspiration for some of that information?
I would have to say probably not. I'm just guessing because I don't have any actual information, but I mean, I've heard people from all different arenas say the same thing where, you know, especially when they get their so-called inspiration, that inspiration, you just don't always know where that inspiration came from, you know? And if there's this evil force out there, you know, that's the way that seems like the easiest way to, you know, do whatever you want to do would be to inspire somebody with your inspiration, so to speak, and they would think it was their inspiration. So, I mean, very possible. And that's a lot of the reason, I mean, that scenario kind of is a lot of the reason I like to talk about these plazas and these parks, because these places are catalysts, I think, for information. But they, you know, if the wrong people were trying to get the wrong information to flow through these parks and people weren't aware of what was happening, you know, that could be an issue. You know, see, I go down there and I've had wonderful times. But if these places went unrecognized for years and somebody was able to actually use them as a catalyst for, you know, whatever they wanted to use them for, to harness this energy or whatever they wanted to do, they could. So I think that's why I feel it's important to talk about these places and make people aware of these places, so hopefully they don't go under the radar and won't be able to be used in such a fashion.
Well, this happens in a lot of places throughout the world, here in Australia, where there would be these Aboriginal sites, and not far from where I live, there's actually a sacred Aboriginal site where these shipwrecked Egyptians actually carved their hieroglyphs, and it turned out to be an obscure proto-Egyptian, which if it was meant to be a hoax, it would, why would they use proto-Egyptian, right, which most Egyptologists weren't even aware of until the recent past. But the point of relevance is there's always this push and pull, Chad, where people like us come along, we honor the place, we have reverence for the place. They have a big grandmother tree there that the Aboriginals love and venerate. And there's all these carvings into it, people putting, you know, drawing graffiti and etching stuff into it. And then we also get the impression that sometimes there's these ceremonies conducted there that definitely are not what we would consider to be good ceremonies. And then what we have to do is turn around and kind of purify the place and raise the vibe of the place in the wake of that. So, exactly. So it seems that the forces, the archontic negative forces working through people, working through these vessels, if you will, they kind of guide them to these places to do certain things, to bring in certain types of information, certain types of energies, intelligences, if you will. So there may be that element to it. And very quickly, but before we kind of shift gears, because we're just really getting into the meat of the stuff. All of it has been pretty meaty. I've had Gary David on the show, and he talks about the Orion Zone, and you're familiar with it in the Southwest, in the Southwestern Native American tribes, the Hopi, the Navajo, the Anasazi, et cetera, same thing. They had this thing about Orion, right? Absolutely. And it ties into the lore, because I know a lot of people that they have very vivid past life memories of being in these galactic wars centered around Orion. And sometimes, you know, what they tell me is one of the reasons for these big wars, which involved a multitude of intergalactic and interdimensional races, was there was a big stargate in the Orion constellation, which was in it. I think of like, well, where did they get this idea for Deep Space Nine, this wormhole, which these competing forces are always fighting against and whatnot. So, you know, when you mentioned that bit earlier about the pathway of souls goes back to a big stargate in Orion, I darn near fell over.
Yep. So, I mean, and they have a literal location right below the belt star of Orion. It's M46. I believe it's M46 off the top of my head. It's the little star right below the three belt stars. And that's the portal. Like, you know, if they didn't have any information, you'd think you'd pick one of the bright belt stars or, you know, but no, it's this really dim star right below the belt. And that's the prospective portal. But yeah, I mean, so that I've heard a lot of stories about the Orion Wars and stuff too. And, you know, like I said, I don't know where this information is coming from, but, you know, that's not, that information could be part of it too. It's like, if, you know, if these wars took place and there's lots of deceased and, you know, they would want us to have that information in some way. They might not know how to get us that information, but, you know, we keep getting this Orion information over and over, and all these legends and lore point to Orion as a place we possibly came from and go to, you know, and there's, you know, it's marked out on the ground with rocks and places. It's marked out with mounds and places. It's in petroglyphs, you know, it's everywhere, you know, so there's got to be some kernel of truth to it. There's got to be.
What little that I've come across in my studies about some of the cosmology of I think it's the Ojibwa, is there creator god Nanabush, or is that
Nanabush, and he also takes on the name Manabozho sometimes. Absolutely. And
I haven't delved in, I haven't gotten into scholarly works, I haven't had actual books and whatnot, just what I can glean from the internet, but apparently, according to some of the lore, Nanabush was engaged in this cosmic battle, and he warred, according if I what I read correctly, he warred against what were described as the lizard people, right? So did you hear anything about that in your studies, about this cosmological conflict going on, and how the native peoples were embroiled in that. We always hear you talk about Sitchin earlier and the wars of gods and men, and I was a big fan of Greek mythology back in the day and still am, and you know how these warring alien civilizations seem to bring us along with them as far as these conflicts go. And so what, if anything, have you learned in the Native American lore that refers to this kind of cosmological conflict?
Well, the Ojibwa, I haven't came across the reptilian conflict, but I have came across the giant conflict. Like, there's lots of legends of them doing battles with the giants. Sometimes they refer to them as marine people, but supposedly they had big bad, they refer to them as cannibals, red-haired cannibals. And they also thought they may have been off planet in some cases. They didn't think they were necessarily natural to the earth. So there are legends of wars with them. Supposedly the Native Americans did defeat them, or they left. It's like the legends are kind of left open-ended where you don't know if they were totally defeated or they left. But like I said, you do find quite a few bones in some of the Native American burial grounds. So it's kind of a weird situation, like if the natives buried the bones of the giants, or if the giants had taken over that landscape and buried each other. It's kind of a weird situation, and it's hard to figure out, because when they unearthed the giant bones, they basically disappeared. They sent them to the Smithsonian to be studied, and they're gone. So we end up with no context in what order, you know, what layers they were discovered and compared to the Native Americans. But one thing that's interesting in the Great Lakes, when they discovered the giant bones, is a lot of them were wearing copper implements. Some of them would have copper bracelets. I have a report of one from Nature magazine who was wearing copper armor. He had a copper helmet. He had a necklace with a bear tooth claw inlaid with pearl, surrounded with copper. So, I mean, these guys sound pretty sophisticated, you know, and we have, I don't know if you ever heard of the legends of the missing copper from Michigan, Upper Michigan. One of the biggest mysteries around here is what they call the copper mystery, where we're missing between a half and a billion pounds of copper from these ancient copper pits on this island called Isle Royal. And the only small trinkets of copper have been found through North America. You know, they'll find little necklaces and stuff down by Cahokia. But the majority of this billion pounds of copper is so-called missing. But we find these giants who happen to be wearing the same, we know it's the same copper that came from these copper pits due to a metallurgical test, because the copper that comes from these copper pits is 99.5% pure as it's mined out of the veins. So they can tell where this copper comes from. So we know the giants had some, I don't know if I could say hand in mining the copper, but somewhere along the line, they got their hands on this copper because they're wearing it inside the pits. So it's a huge mystery, and I don't know what to make of it, but we do have, you know, giants, copper, which I think is the metal, like you said, these metals could have something to do with, you know, all these different portal scenarios and stuff. I think the metal could possibly have something to do with it. I don't know how it would play into it, but you know, when you find these portal areas, and even in cartoon depictions, when you see giants, like next time you see a cartoon depiction of a giant, you're gonna see them wearing copper bracelets, copper necklaces, and you know, it's the copper and the giants go together for some weird reason. And the island Isle Royal, where this copper was all mined, right next door to it, well, 15 miles away, where the main land meets the water, the giant mountain there is called the Sleeping Giant. Like, the name of the mountain across the way is called the Sleeping Giant. The neighboring mountain is the home of the Thunderbird. So, I mean, these different entities and spirits of giants and thunderbirds and these different metals, they all converge around these legends in these particular areas. And I think these particular areas were probably what drew all this stuff together, most likely. You know, the giants were probably in this area due to the energy, or the Native Americans were probably in this area because they recognize this is a spot, you know, where they can connect. So there's, when you find these spots, these ancient mound sites or stone circles or sometimes urban portals when they've been built over top of them, you seem to get a whole gamut of all this stuff. You'll get legends of the giants, legends of the star people. You'll have UFO sightings in the same vicinities. You'll have, in Michigan, we have the Michigan Dogman is our big cryptid here. In the waters surrounding the island, they have the underwater creatures called Mishu Pishu. And he's supposed to be the guardian of the copper, part panther and part underwater serpent. So in these, you know, exact areas, we just have a gamut of all these creatures, spirits, and unusual phenomenon. And I think it has something to do with the region. Like there's got to be, I don't know if you want to call it a window area, a vortex point, but I think they all converge on these regions and, you know, the legends surround these in particular regions because there's something happening with the landscape initially.
Well, that's a vast amount of area you cover, Jen.
It is.
Tennessee all the way up and then the vast Great Lakes area. And in the time we got left in this first segment, because really we're just starting to push the ball downhill. And, you know, the snowball is getting increasingly larger because of all the implications and all the connections. The Great Lakes Triangle, the anomalous activities there. We know that in some places, Sedona, Arizona, another big vortex area, other places, Pennsylvania, the Gettysburg battlefield, for example, people experience, for lack of a better term, time slips. One moment they're in the here and now, next thing you know, they look over, there's people over their horse and buggy dressed in period clothes. Both parties are looking at each other in a WTF moment, right? Have there been these types of time slip anomalies reported in your neck of the woods?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's interesting about the Great Lakes, like there's these time slip experiences with people. We have similar experiences that have happened to boats and planes. So that's what makes it really interesting. Like people, you know, you've heard of people having time slips, but when you start incorporating entire ships of people or entire planes of people, well, you know, it gets really strange.
The implications are mind-boggling, right? The
implications are mind-boggling. Say, one person that I've been telling the story, because it's super interesting, took place in the southern shores of Lake Michigan, whose name was Stephen Kubacki. And he was just about to graduate from college. He had, I think, a week left or something. And he was an outdoorsy type guy. And he was going to go cross-country skiing on the shores of Lake Michigan. They just got a fresh snow. And it's something he did quite often. So he told his parents, I'm going to go for a quick cross-country ski. I'll be back in a while. And, well, Stephen never came back. So his parents knew right where he should have been. So they got a hold of the authorities right away. And they, you know, they had the police out there, eventually the Coast Guard, the locals, everybody out there. And eventually, it was a day later, but a snowmobiler found his skis. And they were sure enough out there on Lake Michigan, like he said. And there was, you know, ski tracks leading up to his skis. His boots were stepped out of his skis. And then there were some footprints out of his boots. Like he'd stepped out of his boots and footprints walking straight out towards the lake onto the ice, and his footprints abruptly vanished. So, you know, they didn't really know what to make of it. They kept on searching for another day. And at one point they went back to where skis were, and this is kind of weird. And now his backpack was there. It wasn't there initially. Now, a day later, his backpack was sitting in the same spot where his skis were the previous day. So they kept looking around the area again, you know, still didn't find him. So eventually they had to go back to his parents and say, you know, Stephen must have fallen through the ice. It's the only possibility. You know, it's all we can come up with. So, you know, that was kind of the end of the story. His parents had to mourn, and his college actually granted him a degree. He was only a week away. And that was kind of the end of it. His father moved away and was trying to heal. And well, 14 months later, Stephen awakens in a field on top of a hill, 700 miles away, almost directly east in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And he says he woke up and he had fresh, clean clothes on, brand new tennis shoes, There's a backpack sitting next to him. He said it had all kinds of different maps in it. He had a t-shirt on, a Wisconsin Marathon t-shirt. So I guess he hiked down into town and found a payphone, and he actually seen a newspaper, and that's the first time he realized he'd been gone for 14 months. And he got a hold of his sister, and she's like, well, Dad actually moved out that way over the last year, and he's only like 50 miles from where you're actually at. So he hitchhiked to his dad's house, and imagine the surprise when his dad opened the door and Steven's standing there, looking all healthy and clean. So there was a big media frenzy, he did a couple interviews, but he didn't want to talk too much about it. He said he didn't know what happened to him. He had no memory of it. He said his best guess was maybe he ran a marathon somewhere since he had new running shoes and a shirt, but he didn't know. They were trying to get him to go see a psychiatrist, and he refused. He wouldn't go see a psychiatrist. He became a psychiatrist as a career. When he got older, he's a psychiatrist to this day. He still doesn't want to talk about it. And, I've tried to Facebook him to see if he wanted to talk about it. And he doesn't want to discuss it, but, which to me lends a little credence to it. But if that was the only story, it'd be crazy. But there's quite a few stories, like that, where these guys, stand-up guys in a lot of cases, vanish and reappear, and they don't have a story to tell. That they just don't know. Like he did say at one point, he said, my best guess is maybe, like what happens to hikers in the Alps where they get too cold and take off their clothes and lose their memory. But that don't make any sense. He was found 14 months later, brand new clothes, looking good. So it's kind of a mystery. And
did he seem to have visibly aged? Was his hair the same cut, or was it longer, or did he have facial hair if he didn't have it before?
I never thought of that question. Great question. By looking at the newspaper articles, the pictures of him, they look almost identical to me. Like that's where a lot of this information came from, because he didn't want to talk about it. So you can find the newspaper articles when he first vanished. And then you can find the newspaper articles when he first reappeared. And now you say that, I feel like the pictures are very, very similar. Yeah, when he disappeared and when he reappeared.
Well, it's reminiscent, Chad, to the fairy folklore, where the wee folk, the fairies come along, and or someone strays into a fairy ring, and then months and years pass, and everyone thinks the poor person has died or been shanghaied or something, and then the next thing you know, they pop up, and having no idea that all this linear time had passed.
Yeah, exactly.
And in this case, not only is there the time slip phenomena, but there's the geographical transfer.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Like there's no record of him having gotten from A to B.
Exactly. Right? And they actually looked for people. Like they tried to find any hitchhike. They tried to find drivers. They tried to figure out how he got there, and they didn't come up with anything. But granted, that was 1978. So it wouldn't be as easy as it would be nowadays. But that being said, I want to say it was like 8 or 9 years ago, there was another case where it should have been easier to figure out what happened, from a firefighter from Toronto who was skiing at Lake Placid, New York. And it was the last run of the day. He was with a bunch of his firefighter buddies. He was actually the fire chief. So another stand-up guy, And last run of the day, they all skied straight down to the car. And he decided, I had so much fun, I wasn't taking enough pictures. I need to take one more run, take some pictures for my wife to show her, show her the scenery. So all his buddies were waiting at the car. He was going to go. He went up there, and, he never came back down. So after an hour or two, they're like, where's David? They went and got the ski patrol and started searching the mountain. They didn't find him. So, they kept searching for a couple of days. All his fire buddies from Toronto flew in, his wife flew in, and they're just, searching everywhere, and there's no sign of David till, his wife was actually at the mountain looking, and she got a phone call, and it was David. And he's like, I'm in an airport somewhere. I'm not exactly sure where I'm at. So she told him to go, go look at a sign or something. So he found a sign and figured out he's in Sacramento Airport in California. So she's like, well, get the police or airport security or something. So he got the security. And I guess when the security and police came up, he's in his full ski outfit still had his ski pants, a ski coat, his ski helmet, his goggles on top of his helmet. And same type thing as Stephen Kubacki. He had no memory of how he got from Lake Placid, New York to Sacramento Airport. You know, and same thing, they checked the flight records. He's at an airport. He didn't come in on a flight, you know, and they tried to figure out if he hitchhiked. They couldn't find anybody who gave him a ride. They checked all the truck stops, you know, and they didn't figure it out. And same type thing, he has no recall of, I mean, that's a long ways away. And same thing, he was healthy, you know, he wasn't starving. Like, he had to eat, he had to stay clean. And if you're going to end up somewhere like Sacramento Airport, like, it could have been anywhere, but Sacramento Airport, what a weird spot, you know?
Yeah, and the contrast, because I've been in Northern California. I've been in Northern California or in the snow country in the winter, but, you know, a place like Sacramento in the winter would be relatively mild compared to, you know, the East Coast. So someone like that would stick out like a sore thumb.
Oh, everybody's probably walking around in their shorts and hula shirts, and here's this guy in his ski jacket and ski helmet and goggles, you know?
Well, there's definitely a trickster aspect to this, to put it mildly, Chad, that whatever intelligence was responsible, and these are people that fortunately made it back. I mean, kind of a circuitous long way to get back home, but at least they made it back. In the time we got left, you've talked on other shows about a case that those of us who do UFO research are very familiar with, the Felix Monclaw case. But you throw in an added twist, which I'd never heard before. And when you talked about it, I darn near fell out of my seat because it was an element that I had no idea about. So could you tell us that story, because it's fascinating, and I think it ties in with a lot of the stuff we've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And say that twist was quite the surprise for me when I came across it too. The Kinross case took place up in northern Michigan off of Lake Superior, and we have what's called the Sioux Locks, which back in 1953, this was a super strategic area, and the Air Force caught a glimpse of a unidentified flying object on their radar over the Sioux Locks. So they vectored out a Scorpion 89 jet piloted by Lieutenant Monclaw to check out this unidentified object. So back on radar, they were watching Monclaw's blip, you know, close in on the unidentified object. And as it did, you know, Monclaw was keeping constant communication. I'm getting close. And at one point he actually said, I have visual contact. And at that point, the two blips were close enough where they actually merged. They were in the same airspace. Well, shortly after that, both blips disappeared off radar. So, of course, you know, big concern back at the Air Force base. Well, moments later, one blip came back on, continued north off of radar, and they realized that wasn't the Scorpion jet. So they instantly sent out rescue. You know, they sent out another jet. They sent out the Coast Guard. They went out there right away thinking, you know, they'd at least find an oil slick or find something, you know. And long story short, they didn't find anything. The only thing they came up with is around 45 minutes after the blip disappeared, the pilot searching for him in the new Scorpion said he thought he had caught a garbled message from Lieutenant Monclaw. But this is 45 minutes later, so if he had went down, that doesn't make any sense. But this pilot says he thought he heard a garbled message from Monclaw and he couldn't make it out, but that was the end of it. So they never found Lieutenant Monclaw, and that was, you know, awful for the Air Force. And, you know, like Roswell, the next day they put out a newspaper clip, you know, Scorpion lost or vanished chasing UFO. And just like Roswell, the next day they retracted it. No, we're mistaken. Scorpion lost chasing Canadian cargo jet. Well, the Canadians came out and said, nobody was chasing any of our jets. That's absolutely false. So for the third time, the Air Force changed their story and said, okay, Lieutenant Monclaw must have had a case of vertigo. And, you know, he just got dizzy and went down. And they just forgot about the UFO aspect. So that's kind of where that story still stands today. But the part of the story that has went largely unrecognized up until this point is 6 hours previously, just 6 hours, and 100 miles away on the opposite side of Lake Michigan. there's another Air Force base, TrueX, and they were test flying the same type of jet as Montclair flew, the F-89 Scorpion. And out on a test flight, they're flying around, and out of nowhere, the engine just lost power, cut out, did a nosedive, and dived into a swamp and exploded. Well, the pilots for that were never discovered, but they did discover a unopened parachute in the swamp and said, you know, that's how they made the identification. And they said they must have been, the pilots must have been so deep in the swamp, they were unrecoverable, basically. But where the story gets weird is that the pilot that went down in the swamp just happened to be best friends with Lieutenant Monclov, who vanished 6 hours later. They had been in the Air Force together, although now they were stationed on opposite sides of the lake. They had actually been neighbors for a while in Wisconsin. Their wives were still neighbors. Their wives at that point lived 100 yards away from each other. So most likely, you know, the wife in Wisconsin was probably being consoled by the other wife when she was alerted that her husband had vanished chasing a UFO too. So, you know, it's one of those weird coincidences. I don't know how the two go together, but I speculate, you know, that first jet that went down with the unexplained malfunction of equipment, is there a possibility that had anything to do with the unidentified object that they had to vector the Scorpion on later? And it's pure speculation, but considering the synchronicities and coincidences surrounding the case, I think it's worth speculation, you know.
Absolutely. And you consider the comments made by, I think his name was General Chidlaw. He was, I could be mispronouncing his name, but he talked about how they've lost so many planes, air crews, and aircraft chasing after UFOs, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the stories that we've heard over the years of electromagnetic anomalies, there's that issue again coming up in the messing with avionics and the navigation and the flight controls of planes, leading to their loss in one way or another. So that story about the Felix Monclaw case, and then turned out his best friend was involved a mere 6 hours before, to me is stunning and seems to suggest there seems to be some correlation, some kind of intelligence behind all of this. And so we'll reach the end of a first fascinating segment with Chad Stemke. Chad, can you give our listeners and viewers your websites?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is chadstemke.com. My last name is spelled S-T-U-E-M-K-E. And I have a couple articles over there, a couple books, and just love everybody to check out the information.
And to our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.